You're listening to the Celestial Citizen Podcast, and I'm your host, Britt Duffy Adkins. Celestial Citizen is a platform for promoting a more equitable and just vision of planetary settlement beyond Earth. This podcast seeks to provide an opportunity for conversation about how to be a better interplanetary citizen and a responsible steward of Earth and the cosmos. By engaging the global public, providing greater access to the space industry, and amplifying a more diverse set of voices, progress in space can equate to progress on Earth. We, who are bursting with stardust, can become celestial citizens. Today, I'm excited to be speaking with Elliot Roth.
One of the deadliest architectural inventions of all time was the drive-thru.
We'll discuss Elliot's startup, Spira, and how his team plans to disrupt the global supply chain by replacing harmful compounds with carbon-negative algae to create safer, locally sourced products. We'll also discuss how algae-based products can support humanity's future in space, as well as Elliot's recent analog moon mission with High Seas on Mauna Loa in Hawaii.
You're taking some of the most athletically fit people and then putting them in this punishing environment like microgravity, and then giving them fast food. You're doing that for up to a period of time of a year, and then expecting them to come back and be completely healthy. That's kind of insane.
If you're interested in the social impact of greater food security and access to nutritious ingredients, my guest on the show, Elliot Roth, is the founder of Spira, a company that is developing algae-based products that will make communities on Earth more resilient and eventual communities in space more viable. Thanks so much for being here, Elliot. We're excited to have you joining Celestial Citizen Podcast today.
Thanks so much, Britt.
All right. So, Elliot, we're going to dive right in. Lots of questions for you today. One of the things about Spira that I found so striking is your own personal journey on the way to founding your company. Can you talk a little bit more about how Spira got started?
Spira got started by happenstance, actually, about me solving a problem that I had for myself, which was namely feeding myself for no money and no resources whatsoever in a tiny space. While I had graduated a degree in biomedical engineering afterwards, I was kind of left looking for a job. And just like so many of my millennial friends, it's either figure it out and try to get some sort of job or move into your parents' basement. And I didn't want to move into my parents' basement. And so while I was an undergrad, I had gotten really involved in community biotechnology. A movement to enable science outside of normal university paradigms. And so while I was in school, I had worked together with a couple of friends to set up a laboratory in a garage space. We dumpster dove for lab equipment and collected close to about $1 million worth of lab equipment, from like analytical chemistry equipment that we had to fix up, all the way to, you know, normal hoods, fume hoods and whatnot that you need for biotechnology. And so I didn't really want to leave that lab, and I wanted to find a way to support myself. So I was doing consulting work, and I had a couple of clients that never paid me. And so just like many people in that kind of situation, you got to sort of tough it out and figure it out. And what I did was I resorted to relying on my lab to figure out ways to use microbes as a means of feeding myself. And I came across some research that NASA had done back in the 80s of using algae as a means of feeding astronauts. And that's the Controlled Ecological Life Support System. And the European Space Agency is kind of continuing that research today in the MELISSA experiment, which is another like long acronym. And so I decided to tap into a bit of that research and started looking into the ways that I could feed myself using algae, and started growing spirulina in a bunch of aquarium tanks, bubbling aquarium tanks, and lived on a diet of spirulina and food waste for about 2.5 months when I got started.
Oh, wow.
And so I was taking big scoops of algae, and that was my main protein intake. And it kind of made me realize that, you know, you could provide for your own basic nutrition pretty much anywhere effortlessly. And I became a giant phyconaut, where I was all about growing algae and having people produce their own nutrition. And it's taken some twists and turns ever since then.
I think that's such a powerful story. I mean, you know, there's probably a lot of people out there that can definitely relate to your story about sort of dealing with your own food insecurity. But I think that how you turn that into this really like innovative company is just outstanding. And I also feel like every great startup story seems to start in a garage. And it's like you're the biology version of Silicon Valley garage startups. So I think that's pretty awesome.
This garage was pretty condemned. It had like bullet holes in the wall. It was in rural Virginia, middle of nowhere. And granted, like those kind of garage mythos, I mean, I've had tons of help along the way too. And I'm really privileged in the sense that as like a middle-class white male, I could have washed up and gone to my parents' basement. Many people don't have that ability. And so part of what I was constantly looking for when I was getting started was ways to apply my synthetic biology experience and training into ways that we could deal with problems that exist in developing countries, in the developed world, and in space. You know, my thesis of work revolves around Maslow's hierarchy of needs. How do you solve food, water, shelter, the basic necessities of people anywhere really effortlessly? And you could do that using microbes and particularly algae.
You know, it's interesting you touch on Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Do you feel like there is an obvious, clear connection between how space technology and innovation can improve people's lives on Earth? Or do you feel like we're still not quite at that point yet? You know, we've still got a lot more work to figure out here on Earth before we really start having space and Earth be interconnected.
I think that for the longest time, it was hard enough just to get stuff into space. And that was the main focus. You wanted things that went boom in the right direction. And so that was the main piece of work. And it was mostly like white dudes in some sort of basement somewhere doing a lot of math to figure out how to shoot stuff up into space. And nowadays, it's more catering towards once you're up there, what do you do once you're up there? And how do we actively build a system in which there is value inherent in space for ground-based life? And a lot of the technology that NASA has developed, other space agencies, other countries, and companies working in this realm have seen outsized applications on Earth. Initially, it's all been telecommunications, satellites, things like that. But now we're moving into the realm of how do you make space a livable place, not just habitable, not just, you know, survival, but how do you make it where people can thrive in other environments? And that kind of technology is what's really interesting to me and my team.
So I guess taking a little bit of a step back, but should we all be consuming more algae? You know, why do algae-based products make more sense on both a micro and macro level?
I think one of the key criteria to why people don't adopt alternative food sources has always been taste. I mean, humans, when we evolved, we like grew to really want sugar and thrive on like that hunter-gatherer style diet of nuts and berries. And nowadays, with easy access to calories, you're just looking for the best tasting kind of things. And so taste has always been a barrier when it comes to adopting healthy foods. And in particular, when it comes to algae tends to have this like seaweed, umami, kind of bitter flavor associated with it. And when I was taking fresh algae and like eating that as my main protein intake, what I came to realize is that fresh algae has virtually no taste. And it's only when you process it and break it down that it starts having those bitter notes. And it mainly stems from the pigment itself. Think of it like spinach, you know, when you like cook spinach or anything like that, it starts tasting metallic and really bitter. It's great for you, but those sort of pigments and the degradation of those pigments are what cause those bitter flavors to come out. So I did a lot of flavor genetics research and understanding like why the genetic basis of flavor actually happens. And we started extracting out the pigments. And so the company now produces pigments from algae. We started with a blue, which is a replacement for blue dye number one, which is normally produced using petrochemicals and as an artificial color. And that can be used in anything from like Gatorade all the way to blue jeans. And then our next step is a red, a brown, a yellow. You can produce the full spectrum of colors from algae. Part of the reason why we're doing that is because it's higher value, means that we can really get started and be a profitable company now before moving into more like commodity level products, ingredients, as a means of reforming the basic supply chain that we have.
Well, and I guess just putting on my mom hat here for a second, but I did see that the product that you have, Electric Sky, where I think on your website, it showed like an idea to put it in pancakes for kids or something like that. And I think with any young kid, having that bright pop of color also and like having it be nutritious is kind of a neat product. But obviously, I mean, as you point out, this is a really far-ranging uses for algae-based products, not only for food consumption, but other products as well, which I think is really exciting. So how easy is it, well, easy or difficult to farm algae? Is this something that can be done also in more urban environments, or does it kind of take a more rural setting?
Actually, we just kicked off a class with a community biology laboratory, like an independent laboratory, where you can farm, harvest, and then extract and dye using the algae that you actually farm. It's pretty simple. With an aquarium tank, some sunlight, water, salt, air, that's really all you need as a means of getting started growing. So this can be farmed locally in urban environments. It also has previously been farmed in space. So folks at NASA, and particularly the European Space Agency, has a pilot reactor over in Barcelona through the MELISSA experiment as a means of simulating kind of those closed loop systems and processes, growing different types of algae in what could be construed as a space-based environment, and photobioreactor systems is what they're called.
Oh, very cool. Wow. Yeah, it'll be exciting to see what comes out of that. So in addition to, I guess, working and developing on like the full range of colors, as you mentioned, for products, what else is Spira currently working on and what are other plans for the future?
So Spira is currently working on not only colors, but the byproduct of producing, particularly our blue color, is this alternative protein ingredient that's perfect for plant-based foods. So a replacement for plant-based egg, cheese, or meat. It's really well suited to have that like thermogelling chewability at higher temperatures that you really want when you cook something. And so speaking from personal experience, you don't really like those sort of freeze-dried foods that you normally find in a space-based environment. The more fresh and nutritious foods that you have, the more astronauts are really going to enjoy that experience. But even beyond that, we started working on different projects associated with vitamin B12 production. We're working on other projects related to carbon capture and conversion, which is really pertinent to algae production, wastewater treatment, and then additional like antivirals, different sorts of medicines. And all of these are currently produced in plants, animals, and petrochemicals. And so the same kind of things that we can produce in all of these different categories of production, we can really just go as close to direct conversion from fusion energy in the sense of photosynthesis and start producing it in the lowest kind of organism, algae.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there's like no shortage of opportunities and ways to utilize algae, which is pretty exciting. I guess kind of pivoting in a slightly different direction, but what is your vision for how humans will produce and consume food in space in the future? And what kind of diet, I'm assuming obviously algae will be a big component, but you know, I guess more holistically, what kind of diet could people expect to eat while living and working on, say, the moon?
I think what we see now in terms of an overall diet is really echoed in what could potentially be in a space-based diet. Right now, there is a ton of waste produced in human consumption. And so we're now amidst this giant change to more plant-based diets, much more sustainable methods of production. The way that we currently produce is we work with farmers in developing countries, mostly in these open pond systems in desert regions where you don't have much in the way of resources. And what we've really taken an eye towards is how do you produce locally so that populations have a sustainable source of protein and you enable food security in the local environment. And so as a means of really taking that and expanding upon it, I think that in a space-based context, you really have to produce as much nutrition in a tiny amount of space for almost no time whatsoever. It has to be really quick. It has to be very nutritious, has to be very dense. And by a means of doing that, we're going to really focus on microbial production, whether that's fermentation-based production and fermented foods, if that's algae-based production and using photosynthesis. All that kind of ties together to the sort of diets that you can imagine people having in space. Space is a very preservative-heavy environment for food. A lot of what you end up eating is using preservation techniques like freeze-drying, like shelf-stable chemicals, salting. A lot of what NASA ends up doing is rehydrated freeze-dried foods right now. And so I see an expansion upon that. There are certain freeze-dried foods where it's completely okay, but as a means of enabling sustainability in space and long-term viability and habitability. There's stuff like NASA recently released a deep space food challenge as a request for proposals. And that's kind of indicating that they're taking a look at how do you produce fresh food in a space-based environment so that not only can you survive in space, you can last without needing resupply. Like there's only so many MREs that you can eat in that kind of context before it gets really rough.
I think it's really interesting. I mean, I always get excited when I see companies that sort of sit at the intersection of how to improve life on Earth and then also kind of still having that really futuristic vision about humanity living and, as you point out, you know, also thriving in space. One of the big issues that we face here on Earth is this issue of waste. And people, I think, feeling sometimes disconnected from their impact and how much waste they produced. How do you think humans are going to start to evolve where they really start to understand and try to take action to reduce their waste? Because, you know, as you point out, you had experienced a period of time where you were experiencing food insecurity. But for people that don't experience that, I think it's very easy to continue taking for granted, you know, what you have access to, especially here in the U.S. So how do we really start to change that mindset?
That's a million-dollar question. It's more than a million-dollar question. It's like a multi-trillion-dollar question. Part of what we're dealing right now is the frog in the boiling water fallacy or paradigm where the frog sits in this pot of boiling water and the temperature steadily goes up and up and up and up. And that's kind of an analogy for climate change. We're steadily ramping up the temperature on the globe. We're steadily releasing more CO2 emissions. Our landfills are chock full of pollution. Our waterways are packed with trash. And as a means of changing the mindset of individuals, I think it's less on the basis of individuals and individual change, more so on the basis of corporation and corporate change. Like individuals can definitely influence what companies end up doing, but the top 100 CO2 producers and polluters are corporations, the US military, different things like that. And so as a means of individual responsibility, I think it's up to individuals to push for and advocate for companies to change, but those companies need to adopt carbon negative ingredients and reform their supply chains to really make it so that we don't produce these kind of waste streams. And they can do that by adopting more, like, in my opinion, my angle on it is more biological materials, reducing the amount of waste they produce, and then making sure that the basic ingredients that they use in the everyday products don't produce as much waste as they would normally produce, and in fact, might even reverse the effects of climate change.
Well, and I think that's such an important reminder about the role that corporations play and their outsized impact. I also think that the other thing is, in space, it's very challenging and also, you know, not necessarily having options for frequent or resupply at all. It does kind of force us, I think, to start thinking about how to be less wasteful. Being wasteful on Earth, you can still seemingly get away with it, right? Like you aren't immediately faced with the consequences of your actions. We're starting to be, but it takes a long time before your individual action, you really start to feel that negative consequence. And of course, you could also talk about how imbalanced it is anyway. Some of the biggest countries and contributors to climate change are also the ones that aren't necessarily the most severely impacted. But I think that it's interesting because in space, a lot of this research, it's like, in some ways, I'm inspired by it because it's really forcing us to think about how to really close the loop, how to be less wasteful. And then those same lessons learned could be applied back on Earth. At least that's the hope. But
yeah, there's an entire institute at Johnson Space Center that's kind of like focused on that. It's a translational research institute for space health. And what kind of blows my mind is the amount of salt content and kind of carbohydrate laden food that goes up into space. And you're taking some of the most athletically fit people and then putting them in this punishing environment like microgravity and then giving them fast food in essence. So you're doing that for up to a period of time of a year and then expecting them to come back and be completely healthy. That's kind of insane. And so when taking a look at like really nutrient dense food products, take a look at stuff like the World Food Program recently received the Nobel Peace Prize for delivering nutritious meals to people in developing countries to prevent conflict globally. And I think a lot of the conflict globally stems from like hunger. you know, and making sure people eat a normal, everyday balanced diet and making it so that the three meals a day that you get, it's kind of like the antidote you take every single day to prevent yourself from dying.
Right.
And so if you ensure that food is more of a utility and more of a necessity and something that is promised to people when they are born, I think that changes the paradigm, shifts the paradigm to something where rather than resorting to a drive-through, you have something that's nutritious and good to eat and something that doesn't create downstream health effects and problems for later on. In space, you have this kind of blank slate to build the kind of food system you would want to see.
Yeah, I think that's such a great reminder. I mean, this is a massive global problem, right? Food scarcity, food security. But even here in the U.S., it boggles the mind to me that there are kids that are expected to go to school, expected to function, but they either can't afford school lunches or those school lunches are not nutritious and really not fueling them for their day ahead. And that's in the U.S. I mean, we're a very developed country. In my opinion, you know, it's absolutely disturbing that that's still a problem that we face here. And then, of course, there's many Americans that face food insecurity. I think to me, it's something that we need to address here as a top priority.
Yeah, one of the deadliest architectural inventions of all time was the drive-thru.
It's not only that initial impact of like not having access to being able to afford nutritious food or food at all, but going the next step, people developing health problems and health complications and not having the insurance coverage to cover those illnesses and diseases that come as a result of their diet.
Yeah.
Certainly there's no shortage of work to be done here on Earth, but hopefully space can help with that as well. So what would be the first steps required to begin algae farming in space? Like what materials would you need to bring with you from Earth?
What's kind of incredible is that a lot of those materials we already bring with us. That comes in the form of human waste in the sense of CO2 and solid and liquid waste from people. A lot of that contains the nitrates, phosphates, potassium, that you need as a means of having the fertilizer ingredients to grow algae. And then in addition, the CO2 that you breathe out, that is the main carbon source of algae itself. And so there is almost a symbiotic relationship with people and algae that can be grown closed system. And recently my team submitted a proposal to NASA for CO2 capture and a more kind of algal-centric method of capturing and converting CO2 into the basic components that are used to grow algae in a downstream fashion to provide for food, medicines, different kinds of materials used for additive manufacturing and building.
I also want to jump back to an earlier point that you made about the deep space food challenge. How soon do we need to start thinking about in situ food production, or perhaps put more simply, producing food in space versus bringing it with us from Earth? Any sort of estimate on timeline of when that's really going to be a critical concern?
So to really take into account when food requirements and food understanding is going to be necessary in a space-based context, I think you need to start considering that ahead of any planned mission, particularly because when you take a look at the historical context of food in different sorts of expeditions, that was one of the main considerations at play for any successful expedition. For example, a transantarctic expedition from the crew of the Endurance back in like 1905, food was the main thing that they packed, and their hull was completely filled with all sorts of different foodstuffs for the journey ahead. They expected, though, to make up more than half of their calories from the seals and blubber and whales and penguins and whatever they found along the way. And so as a means of being able to transit space in a sustainable fashion, like when you take into account the amount of nutrition that somebody needs to eat, just taking into account like fat over the course of an entire lifetime, it's about the weight of 8 elephants in terms of analogy that somebody needs in caloric density of just fat. Think about it like eating sticks of butter, like 8 elephants worth of butter for the amount of calories that somebody needs to eat to survive.
Wow.
But you're not just going to eat butter in a space context. And if you're going to send 100 people to a place like Mars, as an example, you're going to need a significant duplicate of somebody's weight in order to send and ship. And so in order to reduce the amount of payloads, in order to reduce the cost of each mission, in order to really prevent additional launches needed to get up into space, you absolutely have to start planning for these sort of sustainable production systems that do in situ manufacturing. Otherwise, your mission is destined for failure from the beginning.
And I guess following that example of, say, the first 100 or even first 1,000 or 10,000 people starting to live and work in space, we'll go with your example of Mars. Do you think that equitable food security and access to nutrition, do you see that as becoming a source of potential conflict? You know, obviously we've seen that here on Earth. What's to stop it from occurring in space?
Exactly. In order to prevent conflict, you really don't want a Donner Party situation in space. That would be one of the worst sort of things to play out. And as a means of doing that, you want to account for any eventuality in terms of access to food supply. And I think as a means of enabling food security for people in space, you have to ensure that each individual on a space-based mission has the ability to produce the food that they need themselves in order to survive, right? Because food, air, water, these are the kind of things that are basic essentials that if you don't have, it gets really scary in space. There's a scene in Apollo 13 where they have to fit that like square peg in a round hole for the CO2 capture. And speaking from personal experience, whenever you have elevated levels of CO2 in an environment, it really messes with the way that you think, the way that you interact with people. And anytime you have a scarcity of resources, it's very important to account for that scarcity of resources and ensure that you prepare for any eventuality. And then almost practice a policy of abundance in those sort of environments so that if there is a problem, it doesn't become a life-threatening problem.
Right. Actually, your point about elevated CO2 levels kind of leads me to my next question here. You recently participated in a 2-week-long analog moon mission with High Seas on Mauna Loa in Hawaii. What was that experience like? You know, can you walk us through what your typical day looked like in the habitat?
Yeah, my pithy response of how that mission was like is that it was out of this world. But I think going beyond that, it's really astounding to take a step back and kind of experience a slight overview effect. Because in the middle of a pandemic, when the world was locked down, I had one of the strangest isolation quarantine experiences you could imagine, where we took a little shuttle all the way up the side of Mauna Loa, and it's this half golf ball kind of dome on the side of the volcano in the middle of nowhere, and everything's dead all around you. And you go up through the cloud cover up to about 8,000 feet, and this 35-foot diameter dome, that's your home for 2 weeks. And that's all there is, you and five strangers in this kind of environment. And all you have is what you bring with you. So there's this scarcity, implicit scarcity already, where you only have 250 gallons of water split between six people. You have whatever power you can generate from the solar panels, and fingers crossed there isn't a cloudy day or any sort of the dust storms that you would normally experience on the moon or Mars or whatever. And then you also have limited amounts of air. That was one of the strangest pieces of my experience there, was our CO2 pump wasn't working exactly the way it was supposed to. And so it was a little slow in pumping the CO2 out of the environment. And we had elevated levels of CO2 the entire time that I was there. And that really affected me, having CO2 around 1,100, 1,200 ppm consistently throughout the day. Now the astronauts on the ISS experienced levels of CO2 at around 3,000 ppm. And once it starts getting into the 5,000 ppm range, that's really dangerous and deadly. And so CO2 and gas waste management and making sure that the air is constantly refreshing really requires a whole lot of attention paid to it. Like, we couldn't exercise at certain points of the day as a means of making sure the CO2 levels remain low.
Oh, wow.
And so stuff like that are things you don't even realize. The water conservation, I think during those 2 weeks, I only took one shower that entire time. We were limited on the amount of water consumption. So the shower that I took was a sponge bath, in essence, like a little bucket bath. Then in terms of doing like dishes, you don't waste water of those dishes either. You try to recycle everything. We had a composting toilet. We had a no flush urinal. All of these things are normal in a space-based environment and really challenging when you shift from this sort of abundance mindset where water comes from a tap magically to an environment where every single drop of water has to be conserved. You become way more aware of it when you return home.
Yeah.
So when I return home, I still kind of conserve water. I figure out ways of practicing recycling things and other things like that. It just kind of really influenced my thought patterns and processes on Earth.
I love how you describe that as a mini overview effect. That's a concept that we talk about a lot here on this podcast. And I think what a powerful experience that could be if more humans got to do a two-week stint in a habitat where they're forced to be confronted with, you know, their own habits and thinking about water usage, as you said, and their waste and all those different
things. Are you thinking about it, Britt? Are you gonna go?
You know, honestly, I would love to do it. I think it would take a fair bit of planning because my poor husband would be stuck with 3 kids under the age of 4. So that would be, he might have the worst experience. I think the 2 weeks stint in the habitat would be probably better by comparison. but yeah, another area I wanted to ask you about is specifically, I know that through this program, a lot of people do experiments. And I believe you had said in prior conversations that you did some experiments for Spirit. Could you talk about those a little bit?
So the overarching experiment was actually that in conjunction with the International Moon-Based Alliance and NASA Goddard, we were tasked to investigate lava tubes. Lava tubes are these channels of rock that are carved out with magma from the volcano itself, and they form these underground caverns where you can explore them, and that's kind of where NASA expects humans to habitate on the moon and Mars. These are big open environments where you could set up a habitat underground so that you're protected from radiation and any sort of micrometeorites that could come along. So we put on full head-to-toe spacesuits and set off on EVAs for up to 4 hours at a time where we were investigating these caverns and mapping them using LIDAR and then collecting samples to see if there were microbial signatures of life in these sort of environments. That was kind of the main task. Outside of that, I had a number of psychological experiments because really the point of these analog missions is to test the squishy bits. So you can test a lot of the technology outside of these space-based contexts and put that through the paces. But humans are really the biological technology that enables a lot of these missions to happen. And so the psychological, the social, the physiological aspects of being in an environment like this are very important to test and track. So I had 4 different psych experiments. I had a Stanford like journaling experiment. I had a UMass Amherst collaboration where we were testing the emotional kind of resilience and ups and downs. Then there was one where I was doing it with a USC researcher in conjunction with the Army Research Labs on testing the efficacy of the crew itself. And then another one where there was a researcher from University of Rochester who was very interested in sounds in the environment. So whether or not playing nature sounds in the morning and evening would enable me to feel more at home or more homesick. And so those were the kind of experiments from a psychological standpoint. Then from like biological standpoint, I tracked all my biometrics. So I kept on pricking my finger to do blood glucose measurements about 6 times a day.
Oh, wow.
Which got to be tiring. I now understand and really commiserate with diabetics. I was tracking my sleep in 3 different ways using a biometric tracker, a sleeping pad, as well as a sonar device from my phone. I was doing meal tracking, heart rate tracking, environmental tracking as well. Then I had 2 sponsored experiments from other companies. So one of them was a bioluminescent glow stick that used firefly enzymes that you could grow to produce light in those sort of caverns that I was talking about, the lava tubes. And then the other one was a moisture harvester where they absorb moisture from the air, kind of like Tatooine moisture farmers.
Oh, wow.
Whenever there's a temperature difference in the habitat, you ended up getting a lot of condensation on the walls. And so this would suck moisture from the air and turn it into drinkable water and reclaiming some of that aspects of stuff. And then pertinent to my work at Spira, there were a couple of different things that I did. So the first was I'm really interested in building materials and the use of mycelium fungi as a means of forming the glue, the kind of scaffolding for construction of edible foods, building materials, different kinds of clothing, stuff like that. And so started making mushroom bricks off of agricultural waste and compost. The other experiments set that I did was mostly around algae, and it was using waste materials like simulated urine as means of growing spirulina in a bucket bioreactor setup, where we eventually ended up harvesting it and eating fresh algae and then eating powdered algae as a means of testing the difference between the two to understand, you know, how people enjoyed it or related to fresh versus dried. And then in addition, testing the growth rates on simulated urine and then the CO2 from the environment. And so that was really interesting to see.
You had a busy 2 weeks. Wow.
It was packed. Yeah. There was a lot going on.
Wow. So out of like the physical structure of the habitat, I guess, like, is there any one change, some aspect of the habitat that could have been altered that would have like dramatically improved your quality of experience?
Yeah, it's interesting because the type of people that go into the habitat are self-selecting for this almost extroverted inclination in the first place. Because in the habitat, there's almost no privacy whatsoever. You have your little cubbyhole room where you go to bed. But besides that, you're constantly surrounded by people nonstop. And so there's no private conversations that could be had. There's no one-on-ones. There's nothing like that. And so the development of interpersonal relationships happens in a group. It doesn't happen on an individual basis. And so I actually think one of the aspects of the habitat that surprised me that could be different is the sound design. And as humans, we really use our visual sense organ, like our eyes, a whole lot more than we use the other senses. And so from a visual perspective, the habitat was pretty good, like it was calming, but that could be played with a little bit using optical illusions as a means of basically creating a space that was more expansive than it actually was. I think from a smell perspective, your nose adapted to the smells of the other people around you. And I can tell you that we got pretty stinky by the end.
So I can only imagine maybe that little water to go around.
Right. Maybe like a little changes there from the smell perspective. But I really think as a means of developing interpersonal relationships and being able to have private conversations, that's really important. Because I was working a lot in the engineering bay, I was able to have one-on-one discussions with a couple of different people that helped develop our relationships a little bit more. And it was something that I think helped overall, being able to have one-offs and being able to go deeper, something that you wouldn't get at a surface level with just everyone around. And so audio design is going to play a lot of importance in making sure that the space feels both bigger and more personable, someplace that you could decorate and make your own.
Yeah, some interesting feedback. I think a lot of space architects probably will be interested to hear that part. So do you still keep in touch with the other members of the crew?
Oh yeah, of course. I'm actually collaborating with a couple of the members of the crew. I submitted the NASA proposal with Dr. Jessica Snyder, who is on the crew. She's an expert in additive manufacturing. And so that was the key piece of expertise we needed for like CO2 sorbent beds. And so she's been awesome to work with. And we still like talk all the time. I also talk with Bailey quite a bit, who's one of your classmates at mine.
Yeah, Bailey Burns. Yeah.
She's awesome. And currently works at Paragon. I touch base with Paul, basically everybody on the crew. We really lucked out seeing as we came together a month before we actually left. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of last minute. Like the pandemic changed a lot of the aspects of these missions. They're now doing 2-week rotations and it can only be US-based people. And so for me, it was really great connecting one-on-one with each member of the crew. And I think something that I did that took it to a level beyond just professional, like where we actually became friends, was being able to do a deep dive and understand the motivations behind why people were there. It takes a very particular type of person to want to go into space or put yourself in that uncomfortable context where we have normally around us abundance constantly, and you're self-selecting to go into this uncomfortable, really kind of tight environment with strangers.
Yeah. Well, and I'm curious too, do you know like what the process is for how people get selected, or is there any sort of strategy behind matching up different personality types?
So one of my crewmates, JJ Hastings, she's doing a kind of macroscopic view of all these different analog missions. So there's a bunch of different analog missions ranging from research simulation or boats out in the middle of the ocean to underwater research to in the middle of nowhere in a desert or the Arctic or other things like that. And so part of what's really intriguing is that this group, it hasn't really been studied altogether too much. You have a very small sample size of people per mission. But when you take it into the overall context of everybody who's gone through these missions, you start understanding a whole lot more about what makes for a good astronaut candidate. And you also are able to test it out in a really low impact way, very safe way of whether or not you would want to go into space. And so I think JJ is doing a lot of research through her organization, Sensoria. And then Kayla, who is the executive director of High Seas, she's seen now, I think, about 24 or 25 different missions that she's participated in.
Oh, wow.
And then helped organize a couple more. And so she has some really great strong opinions on what makes for a good team bonding. She also is one of the ones who's the key personnel in terms of selection. And part of what you need to be selected is a number of experiments or ideas for experiments already planned out and prepped. She loved my background in algae, cyanobacteria, and a lot of the experimental ideas that I had. You need to have some sort of familiarity or background in space, some kind of connection there. And then in addition, personal references really matter too. Right. So making sure that you aren't crazy or aren't going to go wild, trapped in a enclosed space for 2 weeks.
You mentioned this a little bit before, and this is sidestepping a bit, but I'm really fascinated by the idea of potentially living either on the lunar surface or underground, essentially in these lunar lava tubes. So based on your experience, psychologically, what do you think is the better choice? Being in a habitat where you really can't just, it's not like on Earth, you can't just walk out, you know, your front door. Does it make much of a difference if you're on the surface, or because of the constraints of and challenging environment that you're in, is there really sort of no difference in your mind to being underground?
One of the more memorable EVAs that we went on, most of the time we were going down underground into caves. And one of the experiences I had was we went down into this really narrow cavern, and then you climb through this little crevice and you wind up in this almost like cathedral-like space, and it's pitch black. And you turn on your lights and you realize that there's this high rafter ceiling above you. And it's astounding to know that deep underground, and you're just like walking around on the surface, you've no clue this kind of space is underground. And so it's almost like secretive and safe to be in your little warren down there. At the same time, my favorite experience on EVA was going out at nighttime right outside the habitat. And you look up at the stars and you realize that is the reason why you're there. Like, you're not there as a means of spending time inside the habitat. You're not there as a means of being safe and secure in your little hidey hole. You're there because you're there to explore the cosmos and look at the stars. And so I think there is this connection, especially if you were on the moon, to look back at the Earth and kind of see where you came from and see where you could go. And it's really, really important to have that surface connection.
I love that because it's something that is talked about a lot in urban planning, actually. And it's something I've been thinking a lot about recently is if you look at the City Beautiful movement, which, you know, of course, had its flaws, won't go into that. But if you look at some of the way that they designed structures and cities generally, it was this idea of designing in such a way that created a sense of awe, like an awe-inspiring experience for people to feel like they were sort of able to take in this beautiful, grand vista of where they lived and the city that they were, you know, a resident of. And I think that that's also something in space that we have to try to prioritize and think about. We are so focused on just the survival aspect, but I think also allowing people to have, you know, an emotional and a social connection to the space environment is so critical. If we actually want this to work where we do become an interplanetary species, then I think that that is just such an important component, is we have to figure out a way to design structures so that people still feel connected to their environment. Because you're right, like if they go and they just are always inside their habitat, they don't have windows to the outside, they don't see anything.
You get stir crazy.
Yeah, they'll go stir crazy. And you'll lose a sense of place, right? Like, urban planners talk all the time about this concept of a sense of place. It's so important because if you don't, then people lose connection and the project ultimately fails. So yeah, I couldn't agree more. I, on a personal level, think it's really important to remember why we're there in the first place.
Related to that, I kind of talked this out with some of the other members in the habitat. I think it's important to recognize your context and design for the context of a particular place as opposed to trying to mold that context to fit you. Like the principles of Frank Lloyd Wright and Taliesin and like all of the ideas of building to the environment as opposed to trying to change and modify and fix the environment to suit whatever your purposes are is way more pertinent in a space-based context than it is on Earth. particularly because I think if we try to modify the space-based environment in that context, it'll kill us.
Right, right.
So we have to kind of work with it and understand that we may have to adapt as people, our biology, to fit that environment more so than change the environment to fit us. I'll give you an example. I'm a Venusian through and through. I really think we should be heading to Venus, not Mars. There's a whole lot of reasons why. But in particular, I find the aspect of living in the clouds of Venus and internal sunshine really alluring. I think that's something where it's a completely novel human experience that you couldn't have anywhere else in the solar system. And it's so much better to do something like that than try to reproduce what we have on Earth and replicate that in an environment that isn't suited to that.
I love that you brought up Venus. I think not a lot of people probably know about that outside of the space industry, but I think the idea of some sort of like cloud city orbiting around Venus is just like absolutely fascinating. But I think from an urban planning perspective, it's just so important to have an existing vernacular for like what you're designing for. It's something that we've seen on Earth at different time periods, right? Like we've had either civilizations that have constructed their dwellings literally into the Earth and they've kind of worked with what they've been given. Then we've seen other situations in which we've seen almost like utopian planning where people have sort of attempted to create like a blank slate that then they put their future vision on. And I think that's a real cautionary tale, actually, for space. I think there's real strong lessons to be learned there because a lot of people already, I think, talk about sort of their utopian picture of what they think space will look like because they view it as a blank slate, or even like you bring up terraforming, right? Where people want to just go and ignore what's already there and change the environment so that it suits us as we exist today. But I think the much more interesting future is one, as you point out, in which humans will likely, as they begin living and working in space, will likely evolve. You know, we should respect the unique attributes of the environments that we find ourselves living in. And we should find ways to design such that we're highlighting those features. And that's what's really going to make people want to live in space, is going and knowing where you are, not going and being like, okay, I'm in this habitat that was fully or partially constructed on Earth, and here I am, and I'm going to basically stay inside this little habitat until I eventually head back. And I think we've accomplished so much technologically that it seems to me that if we just give ourselves time and we don't worry so much about, okay, we have to have this all planned out right now, today, what it's going to look like. Like oftentimes people ask me, okay, well, so what's the urban planning vision for space? The point of it is that urban planning is like it's little changes and modifications along the way. To reference Carlo Rotti, he's this planner at MIT, but he talks a lot about little mutations and citizens being hackers of their own environment. And I love that because I think it's important to remember that this isn't something we have to have the complete picture figured out. We just have to be making progress in the right direction. And eventually we'll get there, or at least that's my opinion.
In studying upon that, I think there's this interesting paradigm with biology where we've moved from a realm of intelligent design, as we understand like humanity, biology, everything like that, to evolutionary theory, and now back to this realm of intelligent design, but with humans in the driver's seat. And there's a couple of really intriguing artistic explorations of that, like Alexander Daisy Ginsberg is an artist that did designing for the fifth extinction or sixth extinction, and talks about how humans have the ability to now introduce new types of biology that exist in niches in the environment where otherwise they would not be seen. Something that extends upon that is like, I mean, the technology that could potentially leapfrog what Spira is working on is photosynthetic people. There was this paper, Christina Agapakis, where she did a calculation that it would take the surface area of skin of like a basketball court or something like that for someone to photosynthesize all the calories that you need. But those sort of like esoteric, cutting edge, really far reaching ideas of how do we adapt? How do we adapt to space as opposed to making space adapt to us? I think is this new mindset of this current generation of going into space rather than trying to bring like a mini Earth with you and trying to like create a mini Earth wherever you're at. How do you ensure that you start growing that mini Earth or like taking the seeds of that and seeing what happens in a new context?
Yeah. And I mean, we talk a lot on this podcast about, you know, how do we minimize impact, especially negative impact to the space environment? Well, the number one way to do that, right, is, as you point out, adapting ourselves, not adapting the environment that we're going to. Okay, so we're going to try something a little different now. This is a lightning round game of this or that. So I'm going to give you two options. You can only pick one. No explanations, no commentary. So you just have to go with your gut.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yeah, hit me.
Okay. Moon or Mars? Or maybe I should say, or Venus.
Venus. Yeah. Well, moon first and then Venus. Yeah.
Apollo or Artemis?
Ooh, Artemis. It's the new right stuff. It's so much better.
Neil Armstrong or Buzz Aldrin?
Man, that's so hard. Buzz. Yeah, Buzz.
SpaceX or Blue Origin?
SpaceX.
Star Wars or Star Trek?
Ooh, Star Wars. Although the new movies, meh.
Baby Yoda or old Yoda?
Old Yoda. Baby Yoda's cute, but we'll see. We'll see.
Still not convinced. The Martian or Interstellar?
The Martian, hands down. If I had to save Matt Damon, I'd be from Mars.
Battlestar Galactica or The Expanse?
Oh, The Expanse. Yeah, at Yuri's Night 2 years ago, I got the chance to meet one of the actors, and so great.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah, The Expanse is just like, I can't even convey to people who haven't seen it yet. It's just like, if you haven't watched it, you absolutely have to. It's
Game of Thrones in space.
Yeah.
It's so good.
It's so good.
So good.
Okay, Rocket Man or Space Oddity?
Space Oddity. I'm a Bowie fan all day.
All right. Well, that's all the time that we have for today. Thank you, Elliot, for joining Celestial Citizen Podcast and talking about your amazing work with algae, which, you know, I'm now pretty convinced it's the plant of the future and multi-purpose.
Good. Yes. Yeah.
I wish you and the Spirit team continued success.
Thank you so much, Britt.
3, 2, 1. We have liftoff.
And if you on a little trip, my supersonic ship's at your disposal if you feel so inclined. Alright. Go travel faster than light. That little Elon Musk will be left in the dust, so alright. Say alright!
And to all you listeners out there, thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of the Celestial Citizen Podcast. This episode would not be possible without the terrific work of this show's editor, Victor Figueroa. Thank you, Victor. Also, a very special thank you to Graham Clark, who created the amazing intro and outro music for this podcast.
Nobody has to be hip. Nobody needs to be out of sight.
If you're interested in learning more about Celestial Citizen, and I hope you are, then check out celestialcitizen.com. You can also follow along on Twitter at Celestial Citizen and Instagram at The Celestial Citizen. And be sure to sign up for the Celestial Citizen newsletter on Substack. You can find the link to this on our website. A major component of Celestial Citizen is feedback and public participation. We really want to hear what you have to say, so please let us know what you think about humanity's future in space and what it should look like. Please share your voice and your unique perspective on social media, or if you prefer, all of the Celestial Citizen articles can also be found on Medium. So drop a comment and join the conversation. And if you love today's podcast, please have your friends and family subscribe on whatever device or platform you listen to podcasts on, and leave a stellar review so others can get hooked as well. That's all for now, Celestial Citizens. I'll be back next week for another episode. In the meantime, don't be afraid to take up space.